The Unexplained with Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
This really needs one of those big American voiceovers, you know? Unfortunately, we can't afford one of them, but I just have it in my mind here, you know? Across the universe, around the world, from the UK to you, wherever you are. From Los Angeles to Lisbon, and around the world in every corner. This is The Unexplained, hosted by Howard Hughes. 0344-499-1000 if you want to call. You can tweet this show at Talk Radio, or you can text if you want to. Text Talk and your message to 87222. The Unexplained with Howard Hughes, only on Talk Radio. Sorry, it's been a long and involved week, and that's what happens, you see. I love this song. Check this.
I found a love for by the key. Unlocks the heart and souls of you and me. Love will learn to sing your song. Yeah. Love is written in the stone.
Ah, you see, there's method to all of this. That's Earth, Wind and Fire's In the Stone. What we're going to talk about now are stones across the UK, megaliths to be exact. These are the ancient monuments, monuments maybe, ancient grounds of burial, ancient sites of great religious significance perhaps, that are, I won't say littered, because the way that they are is quite often very organized around this country, in every part of it. Some of them you know very well, Stonehenge, Avebury, and many others in different parts of the country. Others you will not have heard of at all. A man who's put together is a guide to all of this. It's a guy called Andy Burnham. His book is called The Old Stones. It's nothing to do with Mick and Keith. It's a field guide to the megalithic sites of Britain and Ireland. And I'll just read a little bit before we get Andy Burnham on here and we talk about some of these sites. This is from the foreword of the book. Megaliths are among the most enduring remains from our prehistoric past. Whether as single standing stones or impressive stone circles and tombs, they provide a glimpse into a vanished way of life that may seem beyond our comprehension. That's true. So that's why this book, which I was privileged to look at today, that's beautifully, lavishly illustrated with fab photographs and great guides to the places, has been put together. Andy Burnham, I hope that's a reasonable sell for your book. I was very, very impressed. How are you?
Oh, hello. You're very kind. Yes, I'm very well, thank you.
You to do this research, you use something that I've never heard of before, and maybe you can tell me what it is, something called photogrammetry.
Okay, well, that's when you have a camera and you use it to take many hundreds of photos facing in various directions. And essentially what you're doing is capturing different surfaces and putting them all together in the computer. So you might have, you're taking sort of little details of tiny bits of the site, and then they're all get sucked into the computer and it generates a 3D model by comparing all the photos, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and this is something that, of course, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, they couldn't have done. All they could do was take black and white photographs and study them.
Indeed, and it's something that anyone with a digital camera can do if you've got the patience to go around and obviously cover the whole area. And if you can get up high, and people do this with kites and drones and such like, of course, as well. And if you can get all the angles, you can build up a picture of the entire site, really, and then generate it in 3D and spin it round, as it were, if you thought.
And look, there are many more of these things, as I discovered by reading your book today, than most people are aware. Most people know, as I said, about Stonehenge. They might have seen Avebury. They might have seen some of the monuments in Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales. They probably can't remember what they're called. But there are many, many more of these than most of us know.
Well, that's one of the things we've tried to do. I mean, we kept expanding, and we got up to, I think, 1,000 sites in there crammed in. There's huge, big ones, circles, tombs you can go in, dolmens with 100 tons rocks balanced on top, all manner of things, yes.
And feats that have, and we'll go into some of these as we talk about some of these places, but feats that would be difficult for us to achieve today, but were achieved by civilizations that we have no great knowledge of now. We're talking about thousands of years ago, and this brings me to a point. And, you know, occasionally I make sweeping statements that are maybe a little too sweeping in this show, just to try and make things simple for my small brain. But I said that we know a lot about space now, and we're learning at an exponential rate about Mars and the Moon and what is beyond those planets. The Moon, of course, is our Moon, but beyond the planets in general. But we know comparatively little about the people who came before us. And we're learning, of course we are, but we actually don't understand what those people were all about. And we tend sometimes to think of them as a primitive, hairy-bottomed people who, you know, didn't know very much and went round hunting and grunting. And there was much more to them. And it's clear from these sites and your accounts of them that they were much more than hairy-bottomed people who went round hunting and grunting.
Well, definitely. I mean, they were farming at this point, and they must have had spare time to build these things because to organise. And really, they're in a sense showing off what they can do making a demonstration for themselves and for their gods and goddesses and such like as to, you know, it's maybe like a cathedral in medieval times to make an impressive structure.
All right, let's talk through some of these. And the book is very methodical in the way that it does it. It goes from the west and south of England and then takes us geographically up through the Midlands and the east and then beyond to Wales and then to Scotland. And as my friend Connor has just said, there's a place in County Meath, Newgrange, which he says is an awesome place, and light comes into the central chamber only once a year during the winter solstice. So it's not only Stonehenge where those things happen. So we'll get into those things. Let's talk first about the Merry Maidens, if we can, in the west of England. I think this is Cornwall.
Yes, the very tip of Cornwall, Land's End kind of end. This is one of the best known sites in Cornwall. There are loads crammed down there, but this is 19 stones and rings. So it's a conventional stone circle. I mean, most of them are just stones in a ring, as you probably know. Not Stonehenge is a pretty unusual one, but this is essentially there's a very interesting legend from where the Merry Maidens has come from, and that's kind of touristy name. It's Dance Main is the Cornish, which means stone dance, and essentially maidens or young girls dancing on a Saturday, fiddler playing with them. And they make the mistake of dancing onto the Sabbath, and that's not a good thing to do if you're in a medieval or whatever time.
Because please don't tell me they met an unfortunate end in the story.
Well, they got turned to stone.
Ah, and that's where they are now. But look, the layout, though, if that is exactly how they were conceived and how we see them today, looks almost like a giant-sized necklace on the ground.
That's interesting. I think in this case, I think it may have been over-restored in that it's been made to look very neat. I think originally that they would probably have been rougher, and the stones would have been different shapes and such like. So I think it's suffered from Victorian over rearrangement, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, but I mean, that must always be a temptation, mustn't it? But apart from having a story connected with it, what do we believe this was for? Was it a burial area or what?
Well, in the case of stone circles, it's very difficult to say because, unlike tombs, which we'll come on to, they don't tend to have burials and they tend to be very clean. So in that you don't find bones or charcoal from fires or anything like that nearby. So they seem to have been revered and saved for special purposes. Possibly meeting places, and as I say, some form of ritual or meeting or festivals, also possibly trading, that sort of thing, where you might meet and do things like that.
So the people, and you can remind me how long ago this was, but the people who did this were people who had what we would call today a society, which is going to be a big surprise to an awful lot of people who just think that these things are kind of randomly scattered there.
Oh, definitely. This is, we're talking about 4,000 years ago for stone circles. They developed on from other things, but they were trading with each other. They had beautiful stone axes, which they got from Cumbria and over in Europe. So they were polishing up beautiful axes and amber and things like that.
Know so little of them, how they communicated, what sort of language they used. We can only imagine, can't we?
That's right. I mean, we don't know anything about their what they did or what they believed, or other than they were people exactly like us, and they would have, you know, gone and farmed and told stories and everything else.
Yeah, in a way, we know more about ancient Egypt, don't we?
Well, but they had language, so yes. Mm. So there's no language.
So they had a way of communicating.
Yeah.
These people.
So there's I'm sure they had they had spoken language. I mean, they don't have language written down that we can read.
They had their ways of expressing themselves. They just hadn't learned how to put that down in some kind of permanent form. Menantol, I don't know whether I pronounced that right, but this is the one that I described as a great big polo mint, in a way. It's a stone with a hole in it. It's a perfect circle. And this is in Cornwall. The Cornish name means stone with a hole, not unsurprisingly. And there are 6 fallen stones around this. Now, that is something that is pretty complex, would have been not easy to produce with that degree of precision that long ago. What could that have been for? Was that for focusing the sun or what?
It's difficult to say what it was because it's so been messed about with, but certainly the whole stone may have come from something else and been stood up, and then there's a couple of stones at each end. It's a quite famous postcard view that you might be familiar with. Certainly through the hole, there's more recent folklore of healing and fertility, rheumatism and spinal problems apparently can be helped by being passed through the stone in folklore. So, you know, similar beliefs going back into distant time.
And look, I don't know whether you will know this and whether you can comment about this, but a good friend of mine, Chris Pearson, who works for British Forces Broadcasting out in Germany a lot of the time and many other places, said that he coincidentally spent today exploring Eggenstein stones near Detmold in Germany. He says it's an amazing place with lots of interesting connections. You know, are the kinds of things we find in places like Cornwall linked to discoveries in other parts of Europe?
Well, certainly. I mean, the idea of building monuments came from Europe. I think it started with large houses, and houses that you really are too big to live in. There's a great timber structures that, as I say, they couldn't have just been houses. And then people started copying that in stone, and it gradually drifted over to the UK and various parts. So, yes, it's all connected, I think, yeah.
So just as today, when you see on these programmes on Channel 4 where people incorporate design facets from Norway and Denmark and places like that, they used to do that then?
Well, I think so. There's, you can see a commonality in a lot of the designs, definitely, yes.
Okay, let's get back to the west and the southwest. There's a place called Belas, I think it is, or Belas Nap, which is a little bit like a church. Now, this is a burial ground, isn't it?
It is. So that's a chambered tomb. So you're looking at a thing that's covered over and has got little chambers in the side that you can still go in, which is this fascinating to go in. And similar things in Orkney as well, and Wiltshire, which we'll come on to. This was definitely built for burials, but not everyone, you know, that you can't fit the whole tribe into these little tiny chambers. So there was some sort of hierarchy going on.
Mm. And of course, one of the complicating things is that we don't know how much disturbance these things have had. I mean, for example, there have been newspaper stories in the last few weeks it seems like a million years ago now, but when we had the heat wave, and temperatures in the southeast of England were reaching 38, but they were into the 30s in every part, almost, of the country, apart from the far northern isles. The lack of rain and the high temperatures were exposing things that we hadn't seen for years, things that hadn't been touched. But other things that we can see, as you say, the temptation over the years has been to tart them up.
Yes, and also these burials, they were messed about with in ancient times. They didn't just bury their dead. In the case of these chambered tombs, they actually took the bodies apart first. This is getting a bit gruesome, and they would rearrange them and put all the skulls in one place and all of the various other bones. And
Oh,
they it
very
seems,
methodical.
well, it seems, and it seems like they would do things. They would do ceremonies with these bones, and they wouldn't just bury them and leave them, but they would get them out and, I suppose, revere them as ancestors or something like that. And they had a quite an active relationship with them, if you will. It seems.
I've got a question from one of our listeners who is also a scientist, Hedy. I don't know whether you will know this place or anything about this question, but Hedy asks, are there any peculiar mathematical findings from the shape of the circles like those found at a place called Angkor Wat? I don't know if you know that place, Angkorwat.
I do, and well, there was another site in Cornwall, which Rhu Tor, the mountain, where we've got three stone circles that seem to be in a triangle, and well, they are in a triangle, and one of our contributors has postulated that the triangle is actually the same shape as the mountain in reverse. And also in the stone circles, you've got three stone circles, and you've got triangular stones in each circle, which seem to mirror the mountain as well. So you do seem to have connected sites. How far they got? I mean, how far can you go without? This is over about a couple of kilometres. This
So
is.
they were wanting to represent what was around them. I mean, you say the Rutor is a distinctive landmark within a complex prehistoric landscape. That sounds like the truth.
Absolutely, and that as well as the monuments themselves, they were revering rock outcrops and, as you say, mountain tops and streams and wells or springs. And this is where I suppose where the idea came from. You've got you're sort of going from revering natural landmarks to kind of creating your own landmarks.
South of England, then let's move on. Stonehenge. It's now known that Stonehenge, you say in the book, began life as Britain's earliest and largest cremation cemetery. We know it, of course, as a great circle of stones, but as we said, some of these things are messed with. And, Stonehenge is not exactly as it would have been had we not intervened in its history. Is that so?
Well, a lot of it was dug up in 100 years ago, but there are still bits that haven't, and we've managed to do a lot of excavation there. And what's been found over the last 10 years in the Stonehenge Riverside Project is that they had that one particular thing they found was a tiny, not a small stone circle. If you imagine the sort of things we've been talking about in Cornwall. A stone circle which or stone pits which presumably had stones in, and the idea is that these were some of the stones that came from Wales, because you're probably familiar with the blue stones that and the stories that they came from Wales and such like.
And various people
Well,
saying that it's a huge achievement to be able to get those stones across, and other people saying, well, if you're methodical about it and you use this particular technique, it's perfectly doable.
Yes, probably by sea, I would think, because a lot of their transportation realistic was by sea. So if you imagine putting them on a giant raft or something, they're not massive stones. They're not like the 30-ton great things that are in one on top of the other. They are a couple of tons maybe on one. So it's probably doable. Some of the things they've found more recently, as I say, finding possibly where these stones came on the way. And what they're actually doing, a chap called Mike Parker Pearson, who wrote our foreword, is as we speak excavating up in Wales. And his idea is that he's found like a proto stone circle, if you like, where these blue stones were arranged in a stone circle in Wales. And his idea is that basically, the people from Wales, when they came down, they brought their stone circle with them and re-erected it in Stonehenge. And he's trying to prove that by excavation and by looking at the stone hole and stone holes, that he's actually, that this is a thing that could, this is what he's trying to prove at the moment. So it's all fascinating to see.
It's a lot to get your head around, but what we get here is a picture of people who were interconnected. They understood the world around them. They might have been able to transport things by sea. They were aware of what was in Wales, which, in those days would have been a long trip away. If you were to, you're going to walk that or take horses out there, it's going to take you an awful long time. There wasn't the M4 that would take you there in a car. So this shows us an interconnected world that we need to be aware of today, because it's trying to tell us something. I wonder if the people who created Stonehenge would have known about, or maybe known, the people who created Avebury, which is not that far away.
Oh, absolutely, certainly. I mean, somewhere like Stonehenge, so much work has gone into it. As well as just the stones, there are vast ditches, and of course Avebury as well. It's absolutely, the amount of chalk they had to get out with just antlers picking away is absolutely vast. So what they must have done is they must have done it over multiple years. They must have been organised groups, and what we seem to be finding is that people were meeting up at midwinter, and because we can see where they were camping and where they were feasting and celebrating, and that people seem to have come from all over, south of England and Wales, obviously, for Stonehenge, and coming together, and as well as bringing their animals, presumably still alive, and then they would slaughter them on site and have a party.
And somebody would have to coordinate all of this. I mean, look, if you build one of those houses that you see being built on Channel 4, some people building the house of a lifetime, it needs project management. All of this would have needed a kind of project management in the day, so there was a hierarchy.
Well, yes, there must have been, but I think that this happened over time, and we can see different people having different ideas and remodeling things. And so, as I say, these blue stones went in, and then they moved them around and rearranged it all. And this is trying to pick out what's happened over time.
Some of these places have, a lot of these places have hints of paranormality around them. And just before we get to some commercials, which I've got to get to, but I want to ask you about a place in Kent that we've talked about on this show before because of its connections with ghostly apparitions that have appeared on nearby roads. It's a place called Kit's Coty, which is an astonishing structure with alleged hints of paranormality about it, but it's very, very unusual.
Yes, there's a group of megaliths in Kent. It's really strange that they're there at all, but they are just sort of out on their own. And it's a very popular place for the solstice as well. And you get a lot of local people go down and celebrate May Day as well. So, what strange things going on indeed.
But would the people who built that have been aware of the people in Avebury, who might have been aware of the people further into Cornwall? Were they all that connected?
Definitely. I mean, we can see from the dates of each site that you can sort of see a transition in time starting from the continent of Europe and then going to Kent and then going to Wiltshire and going across and into Wales. So you can actually date, that the dating has become so good these days that you can get to within 50 years, and you can see that the progression of these sites being built over time is extraordinary.
And they didn't have phones, and they didn't have emails, and they didn't have roads as we know them, and yet thousands of years ago they were able to do this, and we don't know what they knew, how they tabulated what they knew, and how they related to each other. Fascinating stuff. We'll continue the conversation with Andy Burnham, author of The Old Stones, A Field Guide to the Megalithic Sites of Britain and Ireland. We'll talk about some more of them coming right up here on The Unexplained at Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
A radio star is born.
You're going to love
Talk Radio.
Buying a new car can be a haunting experience. Is there enough room for the little monsters? Will it be devilishly expensive to run? Will I be haunted by the price? Well, from only £9,995, the all-new Dacia Duster gives you the freedom to get what you want with none of the ghoulies. Dacia, you do the maths. Participating dealers only.
Your time is now, and every second counts. Register with the Open University today, and you'll soon see the difference. Pick up that pay rise before picking up your degree. Get that promotion before getting to graduation. Be your future self sooner with our career-boosting courses. Visit openuniversity.co.uk before time runs out. Registration closes the 13th of September. The Open University. What's stopping you?
Base to action, man. What is your status? Over.
I just saved at Money Supermarket, and now I feel epic. Over.
Action, man. Do you copy?
Look, this isn't a good time, Base Command. This conga line needs me!
Really, every time this happens.
Save with Money Supermarket and feel epic!
At Subway, we don't do tiny.
Introducing the new Subway Signature Loaded Wraps. Irresistibly smoky, chipotle southwest steak and cheese. Juicy, rotisserie-style chicken Caesar. And meaty, turkey bacon and guacamole. Big wraps, big flavour. Bigger is better.
Subway, make it what you want. T's and C's apply. See in store for details.
The Unexplained with Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
We're talking about megaliths, the ancient monuments made many thousands of years ago by people who clearly had knowledge of each other. But the amount of knowledge about themselves that they've left us is scant because they didn't have the ability to write it down, perhaps as we did. Not in every case, but there are some cases, one at least, we're going to talk about here, of some strange communication. But let's first of all take ourselves from the south to the Midlands and the east of England, and I just want to talk about Seahenge, if I may, Andy, now, because Seahenge was fascinating. It's a kind of Stonehenge at sea that was only exposed by the receding sea off the east of England back in the 1990s, and I can remember at the time, you know, the media were very excited by this, weren't they?
Oh, definitely. It's a fascinating place. And well, it's a circle, and it's timber. I mean, these timber circles are quite common. They keep turning up. If you build a housing estate, you quite often, when they excavate in advance, they find these circles. So that's not particularly unusual. But this one, as I say, we know it's still there. So you're not just finding, you can actually see it. As I say, this evidence is still there. And this had a whopping great tree stump in the middle, and it was upside down. So what's going on there? So you've got a tree and it's facing into the underworld with the stump sticking up in the air. So there's clearly some symbolism going on there.
And we know, of course, about erosion and about the things that happen, especially on the east coast of England with, you know, houses falling into the sea and things. It's a constant change on that coast. So this is something, clearly people lived that far out to sea, and I'm not sure exactly how far out to sea that is. I think it's about half a mile or so. But back in thousands of years ago, people lived out to what is now out to sea.
Oh, well, it would have been marshland at that point, that the seas would come in. But it was as I say, in a marshy type area.
This is a place we haven't actually said where it is. It's a place called Home Next to the Sea, isn't it?
Indeed, quite near King's Lynn. And the timbers are now in King's Lynn Museum. You can go and see them. They got the people from the Mary Rose Trust to stabilise the timber, and they've preserved it, so you can actually go and look at them.
Well worth seeing, because that, you know, something absolutely that's timber to survive for so long is an astonishing
absolutely
thing, as with the
mangroves. Because it's there, we can see that it was aligned, and it seems to have astronomical alignment similar to Stonehenge.
Okay, let's go north from here, because time is short. The place called Thornborough, six huge henges sited within 7 miles or so of each other. But if you look at them from the air, they make more sense. And I could only describe these as looking like a kind of crop circle type thing. And that's a very, you know, crude way of putting it, in a kind of barbell formation. But they only make sense from the air.
Again, they're vast. I mean, they're similar to Stonehenge, only without any stones, but with great ditches and banks. And they seem to be aligned on various stars. People have put the details into our astronomy programs and crunched the details and found out they're aligned on Orion's belt and various other stars. And these henges seem to have been laid out in the landscape in a way connected with each other. And you can imagine processing and sort of experiencing the landscape, and that's something I'd like to try and encourage.
If they only make real sense from the air, how could people 4,000 years ago, whatever it was, have had that understanding to be able to create something? And you've got to look at the book, really, or go online to find pictures of Thornborough, to understand how precise this is.
Absolutely. I think they were imagining how someone would see it. And as I say, you can go and try and put yourself in the mind of these people as you visit the sites and try and think your way back to how they would have thought.
And, of course, asking the question, if it makes sense from the air and they set it out in a way that it would make sense and could be seen in that way, who was going to do the seeing from the air in their time?
Well, goodness knows, yes.
I don't want to walk you down the UFO and ET and all the rest of it route. But if you create something that is so perfect, it's thousands of years ago, and you can only really make sense of it from the air, and it's aligned with the stars, it suggests, it hints, but that's all it does, that those people knew things that we don't know.
Well, and they chose the locations for particular reasons, and they must have had their reasons, and they're connected to the landscape, and they're connected to things they supernatural things they would have thought, or things they've seen, and all manner of things. So yeah, we can have to look at all what we can look at by looking at them, really. Yes,
and you know, even if you're not interested in the specifics of the history, the photographs in your book, some of them are breathtaking. There's one over in Wales, as we move across from the Midlands and the East across to Wales, of Pentre Ifan. And it's just a beautiful, I've no idea what it is, it's a beautiful formation in a fabulous location.
Yeah, it's a dolmen, and there's loads of these around, and these were not covered by earth. These were built to be seen, and they've got stocking great capstones on, which again... Yeah. Getting that on is no mean feat.
Yes, it made me think, how on earth would you raise that? I don't know how many, I couldn't tell the scale of it. It looks about 8 or 10 feet. How would you get that thing in those days up there?
Oh, it's higher than that. I think it's about 12 feet. It must have been massive wooden ramps or something. But one of them over in Ireland at Browns Hill is 100 tonnes. And this is just to form a roof. You know, you don't make a roof just of 100 tons. It's been put there for a reason, and it's kind of teetering. It's remarkable they've stayed up, but these things were built to be seen, and they were built to impress people and built to say things, presumably to their, whoever they wanted to speak to.
And these days we'd have a whole phalanx of men and women in hard hats using the very latest machinery to do that, but they didn't have any of that.
Definitely. But they,
Okay, north to Scotland, High Banks Farm. This one made an impression on me. This was unusual markings on this stone array near Kirkcudbright.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of these in Scotland. Again, the Kilmartin Valley as well, northwest of Glasgow. You get, and also in Northumberland and Cumbria, you get sheets of rock with these cup and ring markings, and with those are the main ones. You get concentric rings,
and they look like some of them, dimples on the stone. It makes you wonder, how did they make those?
They were chipped out. You can find the chippings. There's someone sat there and carved all this out. So again, it's probably something they must have done over years, adding to it, because it's these are granite rocks. Yeah.
It's frustrating, isn't it, that at this length of time we can only guess at what they meant. And there's another site in Scotland that took me aback, I have to say, today when I looked at it. A place called Aberlemno. Is that right?
Yes.
Aberlemno in Angus.
Yes.
Which has, these are some Pictish stones. These do have some kind of writing on them.
Yeah, well, this is a kind of after the Romans came and went. This is early medieval sort of dark age, if you will. So this is where they were starting to. It's similar to Ogham in a way, if you know the markings on the stones. They're sort of pictograms, I suppose, similar to Egyptian hieroglyphs as well. But we don't know what they mean. We people have, you know, catalogued what all the different markings are, but we've got no idea what they mean.
And for me, the strangest of the twilight world of the ancient people, who we can only guess at their motivations, we can only guess at how their society worked, the stone houses of Orkney that have been seen on television a great deal, but are remarkable if you bear in mind what the weather conditions are like there, what the amount of wind they get every year, that those things could survive and still have a story to tell us is remarkable.
Well, I think the weather was a bit better, so they were living up there in not quite as bad conditions. But yes, so they're extraordinary structures, and again, you can go in them. Sometimes you have to crawl in. You know, they're meant to be. Then it's a kind of ritual in itself getting in there, and you get. If you imagine they had flickering torches, and then you'd come upon dislocated skulls and. In the case of Tomb of the Eagles, you've got eagle talons and bones, which they arranged. So this is like a totem animal. You've got, so you can find similar, different animals in different tombs. So that there's you can get a hint of their sort of beliefs there.
And why were they so low set? Why did they not build higher?
Well, some of they're high inside, but they're often...
But they're built down into the ground, into the earth as we see them.
Yeah, and you have to, it's like a, well, it's similar, I suppose it's similar to a cave. It's like a squeeze in a cave where you go in, and I mean, it's similar to perhaps making your own cave, where, you know, if you think back to cave art, where people made art in the middle, in a cave that no one's much going to see. Yeah, the action of getting in there and making the art is, in a sense that it's kind of part of the ritual, if you follow me.
And for my loyal listener, Connor, across in Ireland, County Meath, Newgrange. Now, I wasn't going to talk to you about Newgrange, but talk to me about Newgrange. What exactly is it? Connor says light comes into a central chamber there only once a year during the winter solstice, which sounds like a kind of Stonehenge arrangement.
Oh, that's right. Yes, and there's similar things in Orkney. There's somewhere called Maze Howe, where they actually have a webcam, and they also have a webcam over at Newgrange, so you can watch this. But yes, they're very carefully aligned on the solstice, so you can the light shines down the passage, and so there's this is a vast structure that's been aligned very carefully. So yeah, they're not messing about. They were really had a plan there. Yeah.
And I think Mal in Belfast tonight makes a point. I think I get where you're coming from with this, Mal, that the people of those times had a lot more time. I mean, it sounds like an obvious point, but they didn't have the distractions that we have. They had time to take to create these elaborate structures, because they didn't have, you know, apart from the business of living, which I'm sure was difficult enough, and farming and those things to keep themselves going, they had a lot more time to put into creating these things than perhaps in our century we would have now.
Oh, definitely. And if you think of the north of Scotland in winter, you are in darkness much of the time. And of course, you've got the stars. You're half the sky is full of stars, and that you can't miss them. So that's a great inspiration, a source of wonder, and it's kind of reflected down in what they built, I think.
Well, look, even if you don't want to look at these things scientifically, just as a read and looking at the pictures is an astonishing and humbling thing. The book is called The Old Stones, A Field Guide to the Megalithic Sites of Britain and Ireland. Andy Burnham, thank you for coming on. I know this was your first radio interview. Well done.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. The man's name is Andy Burnham. I mean, I really do recommend the book. It's beautifully put together, and the photographs in it are fabulous. And if you're travelling and you want to see some of these things that will move you in some cases, I recommend you use this as a guide, okay? I'm not on a percentage or anything. I just like the book. The Unexplained Talk Radio, this is Howard Hughes here. This is the kind of thing we do every Sunday night. We mix it up and see where it lands. Next hour, it is pure paranormality. Tony Healy is back in Australia. It is some ungodly hour of the morning where he is down Adelaide way. We're going to talk about some astonishing poltergeist activity and also acquire for you an update on Australia's version of Bigfoot, the big hairy biped they called Yowie. All that and more after the news for midnight here on Talk Radio.
Talk Radio.
Join the Talk Nation.
Dial up and Talk Radio.
We'll get you talking.